Yeah, I think we're good.
All right. We are good. We are sadly lacking David today. He's at Labor Notes.
Yes. Hashtag cursed with a loss. But
he'll be back next week, though. And in the meantime, the Cybertruck is trying to kill its drivers again.
Who could have seen this coming?
So there was a Tesla whistleblower like 10 years ago who was trying to blow the whistle on the fact that the floor mats were curling up and getting stuck under the brake.
That's a problem.
She's been in back and forth lawsuits with Tesla ever since, over the whole last decade of like back and forth libel lawsuits and all this shit. And but anyway, the Cybertruck has a new similar issue where there's a little like panel type thing that goes on the accelerator.
Okay.
And it slips off and gets lodged into the carpet with the accelerator in the depressed position, thus keeping the Cybertruck locked into its highest acceleration.
They call that go mode. The Cybertruck, it only has one speed, go. We're really missing David.
I know, it's gonna be tough. It's gonna be tough.
Impression.
Yeah, sorry about that, guys. You're gonna have to get through it with us. So yeah, it's just yet one more thing. Also, in kind of lighter Cybertruck news, you should not wash your car in sunlight.
In fact, just keep it dry.
Keep it dry. In fact, if you go through a car wash, you will void your warranty.
What?
Despite the fact that Cybertruck has a car wash mode that like locks everything down, including the charging port and stuff. But yeah, if you take it through a car wash, you void your warranty.
How is that even legal?
I know, right?
Like that, are there any, is there any analog? Like, are there other cars that like will void your warranty if you use a car wash?
Not that I'm familiar with, no.
And so, what if you're just like driving and it starts raining?
That's what I'm wondering. Like, what if it rains and then it gets sunny out? Like, is that a problem?
I think it might be.
It seems like it would be. What's the difference between that and washing it?
I don't know.
Maybe like, soap? I don't know.
Like, maybe like the little like brushes piss it off and it's like, oh, I told you.
Don't touch me.
I don't like this. It's in the fine print.
And also if you tint your windows, it also voids the warranty, which does not make any sense to me.
Yeah, that one's also weird, because, like, what could that even be about? Like, you tint your windows and what thing bad happens with the car? Like,
yeah, I have no idea.
I mean, they have already, like, cameras and, like, VoIP and, like, all this, like, surveillance tech, like, in the car. It's not like tinting the windows suddenly, like, hides the identity of the driver to the car. And tinted windows are, there's probably like states and cities and stuff that they have ordinances.
Sure, yeah. You know, there's limits on how much you can tint your car windows.
Yeah, you know, because, cops gotta look in there, see what's going on, you know?
And for their safety. So that's the side. That's your weekly Cybertruck update.
Yeah. I saw there was a sighting in Troy of a Cybertruck.
Oh, really?
Yeah, parked in the rare form parking lot, or at least the place that used to be the patio.
Yeah.
They're monstrous vehicles. Like they look honestly terrifying. Like they're imposing in a way that it's just it looks like something out of the game Halo. Like it should have like a mounted turret in the back.
Sure.
You know? It's fucking weird.
It looks like the Terminator of cars. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And not even like the cool evil T-1000 like liquid version.
No, the OG.
Yeah, the OG.
The mechanical.
Yeah. And just like the Terminator, it deserves to be put in a giant hydraulic press.
Or in lava.
Yeah. Yeah. That would also be really fucking cool. But yeah, fucking crazy that this vehicle maker that's worth the entire rest of the auto industry combined. Keeps making vehicles that suck and kill people.
Yeah.
Pretty insane. It's like
that it's legal, that these things are road legal.
Yeah.
When you can just get demolished by one of these fucking cars that's stuck in go mode.
Yeah. Yeah. Either as like a unwitting participant or a witting participant. And yeah, like I wonder if there's like a big mod community and like they have like a little Velcro strap that they strap around the accelerator so that you can like put your foot in it and pull it up if it gets like stuck so you don't die or kill someone.
Apparently, if you hit the brake, from what I read, it does negate the acceleration. But then as soon as you take your foot off the brake again, like, it's, I mean...
Oh, innovation. You love to see.
We live in the world we deserve.
Oh, man.
All right. What else we got? We have a ton of Gaza news.
Yeah. Let's get into it.
Yeah. So this University of University of Southern California valedictorian has been banned from giving a graduation speech.
What was in her speech?
Nothing yet. She hadn't written it.
So
it was going to have a message of hope and optimism for the future, apparently.
Can't have that.
No, that's very dangerous in these trying times. She hadn't even written the speech yet. Her only crime is being Muslim. Her only crime is...
And being a tryhard. That's also a crime.
That is a crime. That is truly what she's done wrong, is being too smart.
But normally, our society rewards tryhards.
It's true, yeah.
We praise those who pilot the Ava.
Who pilot the what?
It's a Evangelion.
Oh. Oh, you'll be happy to know I watched Physical 100, by the way.
Oh, yeah? What did you think?
That's great.
Yeah, it's really hot, great. Right?
They're so, the physiques.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the provost has cited the need to, quote, maintain campus safety and security. They alluded to unnamed threats, but have not publicly detailed them.
Okay. So... this seems pretty straightforward, right? Like, they are like, ooh, it's a bad time to listen to a Muslim. I don't know if we can, risk, the safety of the function by letting a Muslim speak. Right now, I mean, just like,
it's maybe now the next time.
Year, maybe next year we can listen to a Muslim. But this year, if we're listening to a Muslim, I don't know, like, there's probably going to be, like, a terrorist event at the graduating ceremony.
Yeah.
Is that just where we're at? Is that, like, outside of the obvious Islamophobia here, like, are people in positions of authority, like, you know, like, the provost of the, you know, university or whatever, are they being, like, told by the state that like what we're doing in Gaza is like definitely gonna justify or at least motivate like terrorist attacks if we like allow Muslim people to have a podium? Is like that coming from anybody other than the actual like administration of this university, do you think?
I don't know.
Like it seems super bizarre. And yeah. Like, also, like, there's no way that they thought that this was going to go over without it being a national story, right?
I mean, yeah, you would think that they would realize how much ire and scrutiny this would draw. I don't know. Apparently, she did link to, on her Instagram, she linked to a website called Free Palestine Card, which I'd never heard of. But in any event, it explains how to learn about what's happening in Palestine. The links include statements that Zionism is a racist settler colonialist ideology, no lies detected. That founders of Zionism thought Palestinians needed to be ethnically cleansed from their homes. Again, no lies detected. And then it proposes both a two-state and a one-state solution. It proposes the two sides, the two-state or a one-state solution, for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So this is a little... It does say, so one Palestinian state, which I believe has been the position we've taken before on this show,
likely,
is like the only... realistic resolution here, given that Palestine is split in two, and that's not really how states
It's split into lots of little pieces that
absolutely. But broadly speaking, it's in two little chunks. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it says one Palestinian state would mean Palestinian liberation and the complete abolishment of the state of Israel,
mm-hmm.
adding that both Arabs and Jews can live together.
Yeah, that sounds like a political solution that could likely be entirely nonviolent.
No ethno states.
Yeah.
Ethno states do not have a right to exist.
Yeah, and if we're going to have like a state exist in what is now Israel-Palestine, and it's going to be multi-ethnic because of a project that like the world basically like okayed since like 1948.
Yeah.
Then like it's gonna be a multi-ethnic, pluralistic, non-religious, non-ethnostate, multicultural melting pot where there's democracy and equal rights to every citizen. That's like the seemingly only viable mid to long term solution.
Well, it looks like you're not going to be making any graduation speeches anytime soon, Chris.
Well,
not with radical ideas like that. She says the university has betrayed me and caved into a campaign of hatred. I should say this young woman's name, by the way, which I have not done yet. And I don't know exactly how to pronounce the last name, but it's Asna Tapasum. I haven't heard it said out loud. I've only read it. So sorry if I'm getting that wrong. But anyway, yeah, she feels totally betrayed by her university. And of course she does. I would feel that way as well.
She's still the valedictorian, though, right? Like, they're not, like, reneging on that.
No, it does not seem that they're taking away her status as valedictorian.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild. It's crazy that they did it all without even, like, just talking to her and being like, hey, like, we live in a crazy culture with, like, a bunch of nut jobs. And, like, if you give, like, a pro-Palestinian speech, like, who knows what that's going to do in our crazy fucking country, or like anything. Like, they didn't even like try to like get out ahead of this in the, like, giving the, like, the most good faith argument for what they're doing, like, which is really hard to do. Then that would at least be like the appropriate thing from that mindset. Like, if they were literally worried about like somebody coming and shooting up the graduation because we live in a psychopathic society,
mm-hmm.
Then there's like, there's ways to try to like, I don't know, like bring her into the fold of the motives of the people putting on the ceremony. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, it just seems totally like ham-fisted and racist, obviously.
I mean, they didn't even try to like maybe just put limits on what they would allow her to talk about, like just say, okay, well, you can't talk about Israel-Palestine. I don't know. I mean, you would think there are like
earlier steps.
Yeah, like this maybe was a little hasty.
Yeah, it's very bizarre.
Yeah.
But just to think that like they felt the capacity to just like break with the tradition of like allowing the valedictorian to like have a say just because of her religious background and a single Instagram link that she had to a totally non-offensive webpage.
Yeah.
Like, what is going on college campuses? Am I right?
Indeed. In other news on college campuses, we are currently in day 4 of the Columbia encampment, Gaza Solidarity encampment. So this has been really inspiring, I think.
And where is this?
It's actually on its 5th day. This is at Columbia University in New York. And so today on Sunday is day 5 of the encampment. So far, there have been widespread arrests. I believe 108 students were arrested.
Damn. For just camping?
Just for camping and holding up signs and eating donuts. There was video of the NYPD going in and like stomping on food supplies, like stomping on donuts and stuff.
It's all they know.
Why do they hate? When did they turn against the donuts? It's cop on cop violence.
Yeah.
I
don't even know. It just reminds me like of the, you know, Occupy, obviously, right? Like with the big encampment and how like the very first thing when they like started to you know, storm the first encampment in Zuccotti, they mm-hmm. went like right for the People's Library, like the free library, and the kitchen and like the food, and they're like, all right, we're shutting both these fucking things down.
Yeah.
You can't give away food and you can't give away information. Like, fuck you. But, yeah, I mean, like, what is the pretense of this? Is it like illegal to put up a tent? Do they not have permits? Like, what's the justification that the I guess because you're using the cops, both the state and the university, are, you know, how are they justifying this, I guess?
That it's disruptive to campus life, basically, is really it.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm sure that there's conversations about it being anti-Semitic. Who knows? I'm sure that that's part of the administration's line. But, yeah, just disruption to campus life.
I think that's the point of a protest.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And I think, like, you know, like, wasn't the whole frightening thing on college campuses that they were, like, shutting down free speech and, like, First Amendment violations?
Yeah.
Like, that, wasn't that, like, the thing that, like, got everybody, you know, right of center in such a tizzy over the last 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, but it doesn't count when it's Palestine.
Okay.
That you're not free to speak about Palestine, obviously. There have been student suspensions, including Ilhan Omar's daughter, Isra Hirsi, who was a junior at, I should say, Barnard College is the Columbia's women's school. So they've also been involved in the encampment. Okay. And so she's been suspended along with a bunch of other students. And I saw that they were giving these students, they like immediately deactivated their student IDs and gave them 15 minutes to clear out their dorm rooms under guard.
And how much are they fucking paying this university?
Oh my God, hundreds of thousands of dollars for a degree, I'm sure. I don't know exactly what tuition at Columbia is, but they're definitely paying out the asshole for it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is obviously a very sustainable situation that we have here. Yeah, fuck. Well, props to all the kids that are, you know, standing up for what's right and not participating in a genocide sitting down. Yeah, good on you.
Yeah. And there have been solidarity protests and encampments at a couple of other universities. I want to say Yale. Don't quote me on that. I can't remember the other colleges, but it does seem to be spreading. So that's pretty neat too.
Interesting. Well, here's hoping.
Yeah.
Here's hoping.
Here's hoping.
The situation improves.
In other more Palestine news,
please.
So this is from The Intercept. They have reported on an internal memo at the New York Times that was telling journalists to avoid the words genocide, ethnic cleansing, and occupied territory. So, you know, words that describe the current the current world events.
That have a rich history of accurately describing lots of other things. They're not invented buzzwords for this particular situation. This is what people understand this thing to be.
Yeah.
Because it is.
So this is all done in the interest of using sensitive, current, and clear language choices for their audience. Let's see here. What were some of the other words that they said they shouldn't be using? So a lot of this happened on WhatsApp.
Like the transmission of the style guide, is this like a internally for internalize only type thing?
Yeah, it does appear that it's mostly an internal because, you know, it's this kind of thing. They don't want a lot of light shed on these practices, obviously, because it's very controversial. And, you know, the New York Times is supposed to be the paper of record. It won't even accurately describe a genocide. Words like slaughter, massacre, and carnage, quote, often convey more emotion than information. Think hard before using them in our own voice. And they even talk about not about being judicious about quoting other people who use those words.
Okay.
Yeah. However, such language has been used repeatedly to describe attacks against Israelis by Palestinians and almost never in the case of Israel's large-scale killing of Palestinians. In January, The Intercept published an analysis of New York Times, Washington Post, and LA Times coverage of the war from the period October 7th to November 24th, and which is the period mostly before this New York Times guidance was issued. Mm-hmm. And it shows that major newspapers reserved terms like slaughter, massacre, and horrific almost exclusively for Israeli civilians killed by Palestinians rather than the other way around. as of November 24th, the New York Times had described Israeli deaths as a massacre on 53 occasions and those of Palestinians just once. The ratio for the use of slaughter was 22 to 1.
That ratio, 22 to 1, 50 to 1.
It sounded a little racist to me.
It's also exactly the ratio of carnage
and yeah.
violence, but wow. inverted.
That's a good point.
That's odd.
That is odd.
Yeah. You'd think it would be the other way around.
Well, and now we don't even know what the numbers are anymore because they're totally stalled at 30,000. It's been 30,000 deaths for a month now. Clearly, that's inaccurate.
I mean, there aren't any more hospitals.
The Gaza Health Ministry has completely collapsed. So there's no...
Yeah, there's not a lot of, like, declarations of death
yeah.
when you don't have hospitals.
And a lot of people are now just missing and will, you know, in all likelihood never be found.
Yeah.
So you can't even count the death. That's how awful the carnage has been.
Yeah. Yeah. And is there any explanation as to who is determining the style guide and, like, you know, like where they're getting their marching orders? Because, like, if they're straight up trying to be sympathetic to what they view as their audience, then I think they're doing that, right? But their audience has been shaped by their writing.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
like, it's an Ouroboros.
Yeah. yeah. So
the memo was written by the Times Standards editor Susan Wessling along with international editor Philip Pan. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So it is like the official style guide of the New York Times.
I'm just wondering, like, where the finger gets placed on the scale and from whom. Like, is this like, you know, because we give a lot of, in this country, we give a lot of shit to, like, Russia and China and, like, these, you know, non-democratic, like, dictatorial countries or whatever, even though they have elections in Russia. We basically say, like, that they have a fucked up state media apparatus, mm-hmm. right? Whereas, like, we have the free press,
right?
You know, in capital letters. And it's the fourth estate, right? And I'm just, like, wondering, like, are these style guides and, like, is this media manipulation of, like, reality being done by just, like, a couple opinionated editors?
Right.
Or is this, like, coming down, like, from the top? Because, you know, if you look at other situations, the state, like, the White House specifically, like, intervenes on, like, the publishing of, like, articles in the New York Times.
Yeah.
Like,
that's happened. A long history of doing that.
Yeah. And so, like, I'm wondering, like, you know, did they show these editors the Zapruder film, or, like, these editors just straight up Zionists that, like, are using their media apparatus to, like, create the cultural norms to enable this level of othering and genocide?
I mean, I would say it's all about access, right? Mm-hmm. The nature of the press is that they need access to government sources in order to do reporting. And
okay,
if you
sense.
Prove yourself to be too troublesome, guess what dries up?
Okay.
Your access. So that's kind of always been a part of the function of the press, is to be the voice of the hegemon, because it relies on the hegemon for its very existence.
Okay, yeah, definitely. But you do occasionally see oppositional stances toward the state by, like...
Limited hangout.
Yeah.
Mm. That's, you know, you have to allow some dissension. Noam Chomsky, you know, his book with Herman... Ooh, I can never remember the other guy's name, and I always feel bad about it. It's not Herman Cain.
I always
feel so bad. I have to look it up, because this is just unacceptable for me to never.
I thought of a funny shirt that I might work on in conversation with my buddy Andrew. Just a picture of Noam Chomsky sort of, like, half shrugging, maybe with his, like, hands up in front of his face, you know, just sort of being like, hey, you know, and it just says, Noam saying.
That's pretty good.
Like, question mark.
Yeah. I like it. So the book is Manufacturing Consent, the Political Economy of the Mass Media, which I'm sure lots of listeners are familiar with, written by Edward S. Herman, who's actually the first author, and Noam Chomsky.
So, Ed Herman.
Sorry, Ed. I really do apologize. But part of the argument of the book is that you know, it's not that no dissent is allowed. It's that there's a limited range of dissent that is allowed.
Okay. The Overton window has to have some width.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. Because there has to be the illusion of a varied, you know, varied perspectives within the press.
Yeah.
And it's not so much that it's an illusion. I mean, there are obviously there's the, you know, New York Post and there's Fox News, sure, and there's CNN, and there, sure, are like differing, you know, political opinions. But the problem is that the range of dissent is very, very narrow.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, like this is being done by like both organized political parties, right?
Right.
Like they have a constellation of media that not only do they have, you know, soft or even hard influence over, but even furthermore, the media is actually what creates the liberal and the conservative as political subjects.
Right.
Like the media landscape, like, manufactures not only consent, but it manufactures the political position of this sort of like, you know, bipartisan reality, that is maintained. It's like, no matter what happens, it will be instantly digested into a right or left position through, mm-hmm, these media apparatuses, which then create political subjectivities that have broad self-consensus, you,
yeah,
know, even though they're totally idiosyncratic when it comes down to the actual positions,
yeah,
like vis-a-vis, you know, Trump makes the COVID vaccine in record time, and the entire Republican line is that the COVID vaccine is actually horrible for you and like is a government conspiracy to, like, I don't know, make you femme or something.
Yeah. And it's how, you know, the New York Times creates Zionism as the liberal position by nature of the fact that it's the liberal newspaper, despite the fact that the liberal position on Palestine is far to the left of, you know, is far more on the side of this being a genocide, of this being an ethnic cleansing than, you know, than the New York Times's own position.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's... So,
and in those situations where, like, the media apparatus is, like, trying its hardest in the face of, you know, the popular opinion of these, you know, roughly blocks of people, it's really interesting to look at those situations because, like, it really raises questions. Like, I mean, in the case of Gaza, it's like obvious. It's right. It's just like you're seeing children being blown up, and you know that there's a country with a million children that are starving to death. And it's, mm-hmm, like, oh, yeah, that's really obvious. But it's also just interesting to think about the whole, like, vaccine thing. Like, I've been trying to make sense of that, and I still am struggling. Like, how did being a vaccine denier and or, like, skeptic go from, like, hippy-dippy, like, granola, Jill Stein, like, weirdness to, like, the Republican standpoint?
Yeah.
You know, despite, like, I don't know how that happened. That,
yeah,
seemed to have happened almost, like, without the support of the media apparatus, but then they had to, like, go with it to not lose their audience to a certain degree. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Maybe the genocide in Gaza will be one of those things that just, like, breaks people in a huge block away from the, you know, the official position that they're being told to have.
Yeah.
You know, like, it seems to be happening.
Yeah. I mean, according to polling, yeah, it is.
Yeah. Actually, I think there might be one thing that I've arrived at in terms of, like, trying to understand and make sense of, like, the, you know, inability or reluctance of, like, the group of people we'll just call conservatives and liberals to, like, toe the media establishment, like, party line, so to speak, on the issue of both vaccines for conservatives and genocide acceptance for liberals. I think it comes down to, like, their inability to, like, square the circle with what they understand as, like, their foundational principles. So in the case of, like, the vaccines, like, the conservatives have a foundational principle of, like, selfishness, and selfishness being good,
mm-hmm,
and, like, independent liberty over their choices being, like, the most important thing. And
there's also always been a lot of anti-scientism,
sure,
running through the conservative movement. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And then for, like, the liberals, it's, like, the belief in a rules-based order that from their childhood foundations is, like, genocide is bad, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and you know, like the media is doing its best to try to make it a thing of not trying to confront whether genocide is bad. Like, they're doing absolutely everything to be like, is it really genocide? I don't know. Like, it's probably not. I mean, you know, like, it's a war after all. And, like, you know, these people are, like, you know, like, they support terrorism.
Hamas uses human shields.
Yeah, and, like, the whole thing. And, yeah, like, it's failing, you know, in a pretty stark way. And I just wonder how fast it can really, like... how fast the scales can fall from people's eyes, you know? Because, like, the simultaneous support for Ukraine and Israel, like, how it hasn't just broken the brain of, like, every liberal in this country.
I think it kind of has in a lot of cases.
But, you know, I don't know. Mike Johnson, you know, he towed the line. He got the package out this past week.
Yeah.
For Ukraine and for Israel. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that works out.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I just props to the kids.
Yeah.
Like they got a lot to figure out, and you know, like a dying planet, bipartisan perpetual support for the genociding of a people. It's a lot. Keep fighting the good fight.
I saw somebody say, you know, protest is always inappropriate in the moment and, you know, completely correct and moral and ethical 50 years later. So
yeah, courageous.
Give it time. Yeah. You'll be courageous any day now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just got back from Troy DSA's Earth Day cleanup.
Oh, hell yeah.
So there is so much fucking little pieces of plastic everywhere. Oh, true. My God. We're in the South Troy neighborhood. Windblown
trash.
It is so depressing to see the number of bottle caps and plastic wrappers and straws and broken up Easter eggs and just like little fucking pieces of plastic trash everywhere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I hate it.
Yep. I also hate it.
So every year, Troy DSA goes out and does a little trash cleanup in the neighborhood.
Fuck yeah.
And it's pretty cool. They had, by the time I left, they had about 5 big bags of trash. That they had picked up.
Nice.
So, so props to everybody who came out today. It was cold and windy and gray and gross and it fucking sucked outside. Spirits were high. There was a really good turnout. So just wanted to give props to everybody who showed up today.
Hell yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I also want to give props to you in your healing journey. I see
Thank
you got
you.
Your new fancy Zero shoes. How are those working out?
They're awesome. You know, I've always balked at spending $100 on shoes. I don't know why. That's probably why my feet are so fucked up. Because I'm like, $100 on shoes? That seems excessive. But you know what? They were totally worth it. They were a Christmas present. Thank you, Mom. And they're fucking awesome. I love them.
Hell yeah.
So I've been trying to walk every day. David and I are taking a little trip for our 10th wedding anniversary next month.
Nice.
We're going to Montreal. And we're going to be doing a lot of walking. So I've been trying to I'm in training mode.
Hell yeah.
Trying to build up my stamina. I'd like to be able to walk for 5 miles. That's
Fuck
my
yeah.
goal.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I've been a big advocate for zero drop shoes, the wide toe box for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
They really helped me. I was getting a lot of muscular strains and sprains and injuries when I first started running. And when I switched to basically rubber gloves on the bottom of my feet, I had a way less.
Yeah.
And it just really helped with, you know, not getting injured, I guess. And I've also been watching YouTube videos on there's this guy, I think he's in his late 60s or early 70s, but the dude can still dunk. Which
wow.
is an incredible athletic feat. And he sort of talks about his recovery and routine and stuff. And he talks about how the human body is the best piece of equipment.
Uh-huh.
And then the second best piece of equipment is the floor.
Okay.
And I was I don't know about that.
There's floor everywhere you go.
It's true.
That's convenient.
It's true. But I'm I like my soft bed and I sitting in chairs, all that stuff. And he was showing all these deep and uncomfortable stretches of the big toe and the foot and the ankle and getting into deep squats and stuff like that. And apparently he just swears by just spending about 30 seconds on each one, but like trying to get to like a 3 out of 10 on the pain scale, mm-hmm. and just increasing range of motion of like all of the major like ligaments and muscle groups and stuff. And apparently it's working for him.
They say stretching is the key to aging well. Like, it's very, very important to stretch every single day.
Yeah. And I've been doing some more stretches, and it's been helping. I've got good. Like, I do the, dowel stretch where you like hold the dowel out in front of you, you know, with your hands a little bit wider than shoulder. And then you sort of just like rotate it all the way behind you.
Oh my
you.
God. I'm watching Chris do this right now. It looks painful.
Well, it's that 3 out of 10, you know, you don't want it to like be painful enough that you re-injure yourself. But you want to like it to be uncomfortable enough that your body makes specific adaptations to induced demands. Mm-hmm. The said principle, which I'm realizing like is absolutely true to at least my physiology and probably also my psychology.
Mm, yeah.
So I'm trying to take
a little pain is good.
Yeah.
In all ways.
We adapt specifically to induced demands.
And there's going to be pain.
Yes.
It might as well be self-induced.
Yes, exactly. And as we get older, it's like, you know, we're going to be sore either from working out or not working out.
Yep.
Or they're going to be sore from stretching or not stretching.
Yep.
You know, and so, yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. Good for us.
Yeah.
We're doing great.
We're trying. That's what matters, you know? Incremental improvement is a real balm for at least my anxieties.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I can actually make progress at this little thing, even though the whole world seems to be completely out of my control, spiraling into chaos.
So should we talk about this man who set himself on fire outside the Trump trial?
Why not?
I mean,
let's talk about it.
Yeah, it's really, so it's Max Azzarello. He threw a bunch of these pamphlets all around himself, and then he set himself on fire. Second self-immolation in as many months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least someone that we know of.
This pamphlet, though, is, you know, you were talking earlier, Chris, off mic about how, like, these two self-immolations have affected you so differently because one, you can totally relate to the mindset of the person who did it, and the other, you
raise more questions than answers, I guess, is sort of how I was feeling at the time.
But maybe we should talk a little bit about this pamphlet.
Sure.
Titled Dipshit Secrets of Our Rotten World.
That's a great album name.
It's a killer album name.
Like, you know, maybe like I think the biggest tragedy of self-immolation to me is like these people are obviously so committed to doing this, you know, what they're doing, that they're willing to do like probably the most unthinkable thing, at least to me, mm-hmm. like the thing that I recoil from like the most,
yeah,
as a psychological idea. And it's just like, man, if you have this fucking focus and dedication, it's like, what else could you have done?
Yeah.
You know,
what could you have accomplished?
Oh yeah. Or just,
but like, I mean, I guess you get to the point where you feel like this is the only way you can accomplish anything meaningful.
Yeah. But it's
otherwise,
also,
why else would you subject yourself to it?
Yeah, yeah. But please, I didn't actually know much about the actual pamphlet and or reasons that this individual did this. So
it's confusing, especially given the fact that he selected the Trump trials as the venue. You would have thought maybe that it would have something
to do with Trump.
To do with that. And I guess, like, yeah, it is about, you know, our, quote, criminal government. So, Dipshit Secrets of Our Rotten World. When the economy collapses and it feels like World War III overnight, you'll know exactly why. An Occupy Returns booklet. Our only goal, abolish our criminal government and replace it with one that serves all. We are the 100%. 100%. Fascinating.
So, this guy's like Occupy-pilled.
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
So he starts off by talking about Peter Thiel, who started a bank run on a Silicon Valley bank, as we all know, uh-huh. Leading to one of the fastest and largest bank collapses in U.S. history.
True.
He calls this one of the most suspicious events in world history.
Okay.
Bold claim. The authors, he said, he refers to the authors. I don't know who the other author is, but in any event.
Of the pamphlet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Says that they have done 1,500 hours of research since, uncovering preposterous crimes that affect all our health, safety, and prosperity. Then he lays out a couple of facts about Peter Thiel, blah, 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 his connection to Jeffrey Epstein, as well as Elon Musk and Facebook, inventor Mark Zuckerberg, blah, blah, blah. Then it has a section on cryptocurrency. Crypto is a mysterious, unregulated currency in the world's first planetary decentralized Ponzi scheme industry, with its own high-frequency trading shadow banking theft network. Every dollar that was used to buy crypto was stolen via the U.S. stock market, but its theft has not yet been revealed.
Huh.
Yeah. Then there's a little explainer about what a Ponzi scheme is. You know, con artists promise a lucrative investment, but they steal the money instead.
Yeah, I'm with them on, you know, crypto being a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm also not quite sure how that has to do with the stock market. Go on.
All will be revealed, not in this pamphlet, but somewhere at some point, apparently.
Yeah.
Talks about some of the biggest Ponzi scheme players, Elon Musk, Jeffrey Epstein, the Clinton crime family, obviously.
Of course.
Ross Perot, maybe a little bit more surprising.
Yeah. That's a deep cut.
Yeah.
So even the third party challenger.
Yeah, right. Let's see here. So then some stuff about the CIA. CIA is a secret criminal organization. They never tell us about anything they do.
True.
And everything we find out about is kidnappings, assassinations, military coups, drug running, and literal brainwashing.
True.
This all amounts to a secret kleptocracy. From then on, ever since George W. Bush, who was the CIA director, in 1988, he became president, and from then on, the explicit goal of the government was to steal from the public while pretending it's a democracy. In other words, our government is a cult with state power.
True.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. So this individual was still alive, probably voting for RFK Jr.?
Could be.
Okay.
Yeah, could be. Or Marianne Williamson, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Then he talks about kayfabe. So Ponzi schemes require kayfabe. The con artists need to justify their missing money that they stole. The companies stealing crypto money use all sorts of kayfabe to explain poor performance. For example, Budweiser and Target pretended to have wildly successful anti-trans boycotts against them. PayPal and BlackRock moved lots of crypto on their books. When crypto collapses, so will their stocks. Zoom and Peloton blamed poor management decisions on their massive falls from their peaks.
Interesting. So he's saying that these large cap corporations are like invested in crypto and weren't the winners in the Ponzi scheme, like didn't, you know, get out on top automatically knowing the inside trading. Like,
so he's basically saying that they're stealing from their own companies in order to make money on crypto.
Interesting.
And in order to cover up the theft, they're blaming these external factors. He doesn't mention like the Walgreens and, you know.
The idea is that like it's people within these organizations that are writing off losses that more than they actually are so that they can embezzle the money into crypto winnings and then privatize that wealth?
That's what I take away from it.
Okay.
He doesn't get that specific, but that's the impression that I get.
Okay.
When shit hits the fan, we know crypto will collapse the economy soon because of the March 2023 bank failures. These signals that they are no longer investing in crypto Ponzi pool. When it does, the government will use kayfabe to shift the blame from crypto. We don't know all the details, but evidence points to a false flag account that gets blamed likely on Russia or China.
Okay.
Power grid attack or internet outage. Then he says that the Titan submersible implosion was fake. There is no evidence, no video evidence it could go to deep sea. And just like Richard Branson's Virgin Oceanic Ponzi scheme.
Well, didn't it not go to deep sea?
That was part of the problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Expect a strange event and the promotion of bullshit conspiracy theories around it.
But not this one.
No, not this one.
Okay. All right.
Then he talks about Harvard University, super crime school.
I mean, once again, yep. No lies detected.
Yep. Other schools, Stanford, NYU, UNC, which is actually, I believe he was a graduate of.
What was that phrase? Super crime school?
Super crime school.
That's also a really great album title.
Maybe a next Zombie Giuliani song title.
Ah, man, maybe.
Then it takes a little bit of a hard turn. The Simpsons is evil brainwashing.
What?
Yeah. So The Simpsons has had 27 writers who went to Harvard. That's so they can serve their criminal interests through popular media. The goal, tell us the American dream is dead because we're too oafish, divided, and morally decayed while big business and government bleed us dry. The monorail episode, because we're collectively stupid, we have no choice but to listen to dazzling Ponzi schemers. Lisa, the iconoclast, if anybody ever tells you that our government was taken over by con artists, it's best to ignore, attack, and dismiss them.
What?
Do it for her. One of the show's most touching moments tells us we're best off slaving away for rich, evil bosses. So, yeah.
I mean, this is this is a stretch for me. I mean, like, it seems way, way more likely that a bunch of really smart, funny people are able to mine the deep vein of fucked up, idiosyncratic bullshit of our society to make comedy out of it than it being propaganda to, like, make us
be complacent
with this, like,
yeah,
like, I mean, like, the monorail episode is talking about how it's funny that we're so gullible and ridiculous and that there's so many obvious examples that are just like this,
and it teaches us not to fall for Ponzi schemes
because we're right? in on the joke,
right?
Yeah
I don't know, I can't go down this road with them.
Okay, yeah, same here.
Okay, next is haunted carny meme pages. Do you know any popular meme?
What?
Haunted carny meme pages.
Man, this guy's got turn of phrase.
Yeah.
Like, this should have just been a punk album.
Do you follow any popular meme pages online? No matter the niche, you'll find some common themes in your feed. All problems, no solutions. Tell us over and over that the world is terrible. Instill learned helplessness so they think there's nothing we can do about it. So political discord. Tell us the problem isn't those stealing all the money. It's people just like us with different politics. Snark, irony, and bitterness. Tell us we should be assholes, that we should clap back at others and make us pissed off at our fellow man. Nostalgia for when the American dream wasn't dead. Convince us we can only dream of better circumstances that passed us by.
Yeah, I think it's really sort of inverted to look at, like, the most obviously, like, people, like, meme culture is folk art. It's like, yeah. It's made by millions and millions of people who aren't coordinated by some cabal, unless it's happening through, like, microwave dream radiation or something, to have these feelings. Like, these feelings are just the natural occurrence, an emergence.
And the reflection of the world that we live in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, the idea that they are put out by, I guess, the evil billionaires. Like, does he think, like, Peter Thiel's, like, got a meme farm? And he, like, wakes up every morning, like, drinks his, you know, kid's blood and, like, goes downstairs and is like, how are the memes going? Are you destroying everyone's spirit of revolution? Are you keeping everybody from recognizing their immediate solidarity with their fellow man?
Ross Perot's down in his basement, like, tapping away at the keyboard warrioring.
Yeah, and they're like, no, we got a purple groiper. They're like, great work, boys. Keep it up.
Then, of course, is the truth about 9/11, which was meant to keep us in fear. Aside from the endless war profiteering, nationalism, and increased surveillance, it was so that we would never forget that the American dream is dead and we live in hell world.
I mean, you know, like,
some of it's just true. Yeah,
some absolutely. Of it's true.
The truth about COVID, yikes.
All right, well, let's see.
Their most evil Ponzi scheme, kayfabe. How did they disguise history's most glaring stock market anomaly from the theft of trillions via crypto? They unleashed a pandemic and called the most criminal companies the stay-at-home stocks.
Whoa. Okay. So, it's crypto behind it all. Like, that's like the New World Order thing, animus, like driving all the rest of the coordination. Mm-hmm. And that COVID, a biological reality, a viral thing that was almost certainly a lab leak that killed millions of people, mm-hmm. Was to cover up their crypto losses.
Yep.
Okay, I can't go.
Well, there. Stock market losses that were diverted into crypto gains. Yeah. Okay. Is everybody in on it? It's like cheating at the Tour de France. It isn't everybody, but it is all the winners. So that should answer your question earlier about who's doing the meme pages.
So everybody who's doing well is behind the meme pages.
Yeah. What
I have a lot of evidence to suggest that isn't the case.
Okay, last page. What to do next?
Okay.
You are in a growing number of people who know the truth.
Okay.
Spread it in the face of information and we'll defeat our haunted carny government in no time. Want to be a hero? Share these secrets. Want to be a prophet? Do it before the economic collapse. Important people to tell. The military and police, let them know they're being conned. College students, they dream of revolutions. Unions, activists, and protest groups, they've got infrastructure for action. Everybody, tell them we are free. And then more info, reddit.com/r/MrSamsonite, Google Ponzi papers or dipshit secrets. And then finally, and this is really sad, contact maxcazzarello@gmail.com.
Think someone's checking that email
still? I don't know.
I mean, we could contact it.
We could.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is sad. This is sad.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is, you know, from my view, this is the reflection of true psychological desperation, mm-hmm. right? And this person, you know, like, is complaining about all problems, no solutions, right? But the solution that the pamphlet talks about is just like information awareness,
mm-hmm.
and that's it? And
yep.
like, no, then what? So like, we can stop the evil billionaire crypto cabal by knowing about it? And if we all know about it, and we all just, quote, stand up at once.
Yeah.
Lickety split, right?
Yeah.
Certainly you don't need anything more specific, no tactics or strategy.
Well, that's why you got to tell the activists.
Okay. So you tell the activists, you tell the college kids, they love revolution. I mean,
got to tell the unions,
got to tell the cops,
got to tell the cops. Cops got to be in on it.
Got to be in on it. They got to know how they're pawns. And so once they know they're pawns, then lickety split,
lickety split.
Yeah, this is really sad.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was listening to another podcast and this guy was, you know, sort of not gloating, but like, see, I was right about like a prediction that he made that what do you call it? Like anybody really could have made, but he's like, see, it's happening. And he was like sort of self-congratulatory. And it was around the volcano group setting fire to the pylons that supplied power to the Tesla factory.
Okay. Not familiar with this.
This has happened in, I think, Germany. There was like an eco-activist group, like underground, that mm-hmm. did a act of arson that like disabled power, I think, to like a couple 10,000 people, but most importantly to a Tesla gigafactory.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, I guess, is that they were pointing to like, you know, electric cars are obviously not a solution to like the climate or ecological or ecocidal crisis. And that like by targeting this, thing, it creates a dynamic that's like, oh, like even the efforts of industrial capitalism to like greenwash their way into making more profits while the planet burns by making hypothetically better but still terrible technology is like going to be targeted and, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. And the podcaster was basically saying like, see, I knew this would happen. I knew this would happen because if you don't have a robust international governmental group of, you know, peer parents, like leaders, actually taking climate change seriously and like doing things to try and make humanity survive the 21st century, then people will be resorted to stochastic, you know, not helpful eco-terror.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, see, I predicted it. It's like, okay. Yeah, I wouldn't have argued that that wasn't going to happen. You know, right. Like, yeah, that is obviously what's going to happen outside of a collective, you know, clear-eyed strategic transition to different mode of production, mode of fuel and power and infrastructure, mode of transportation, like all the things that are needed. And like, it's one of those things that like, I don't know. It's just like, that's where we're at. We're like at the point of like feeling like our win is to be like right about things going horribly. And then the only response people having to being like totally uncoordinated, random acts of horror, or you know, I guess, you know, in the sense of self-immolations, but, or just like, you know, just wildcat destruction and sabotage of industry,
mm-hmm.
you know? And like, I don't know, that's like, I'm not going to be happy about being right about these things.
Yeah.
You know? Like, we need to, I guess I really want to, if I'm going to be right about something and be proud about it, it's going to be trying to come up with either a strategy or a tactic set that will like lead to actual coordinated change yeah. in our society. Like, let's put our thinking caps on about that and mm-hmm. like, you know, like start trying to win bets on a better world being made more possible than not.
It's a very tragic loss.
Yeah.
I'm sorry for his friends and family.
Yeah. And, you know, this person had obviously some like literary talent, you know, like those are really good turns of phrase. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think that just giving people information about how bad things are and sort of even like the machinations of like how the bad world like works, is like nearly sufficient. And, you know, like, I know we do a lot of that on this podcast, right? Like, cause it's the podcast is about trying to like sense make of like what is happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But like, yeah, I think that, if there, we're going to have a chance of making this world better, it can't just be like,
tell everybody about crypto.
Yeah. Or like, you know, Google the Bilderberg group or like whatever. It's going to be like, oh, like, if we don't want this reality to keep trending in this direction, we have to organize. We have to like trust each other. We have to take care of each other because we're clearly showing signs of psychological break, of ecological break, a climatic break, of like a break in the capacity for a lot of just the flows to endure and continue. And it's like, I don't know. I think if I have a reason for like hope, right, in the sense of demonstrable evidence that's coming our way, it's from like labor organizing and
sure.
in coming from like political organizing, like on college campuses and, you know, like even just, can I talk about the Houthis?
Sure.
Like, which is to say, like, I don't agree with the Houthis' political platform, right? They are like an explicitly anti-Semitic, like
reactionary,
yeah. you know, politically, religiously conservative type thing. But like, when there was a genocide going on, they're like, we must do something.
We must do something drastic.
Not only drastic, but to like interrupt the fucking flows.
Yeah.
We need to like actually go and fucking stop business as usual mm-hmm. from being able to do. And they looked around and they're like, well, we got guys in AKs and helicopters and GoPros.
We're right on this body of water.
We are in a strategic position. We have the political organization to pull this off. We're going to go waylay some vessels.
Yeah.
We're going to go make propaganda about it. And like, they did that shit. Yeah. Right. And like, if enough people in the world were able to look at the resources that they have to bring to bear and like organize and then bring them to bear. Like
that would be a different world.
I mean, they made,
hopefully only our side does it though.
I like to, I like to think that if enough, enough people do it, then eventually the population percentage, that is our side, increases and maximizes and becomes a lot more visible, yeah. Right? Because it seems like the vast majority of people that I would consider like, I don't know, like good hearted, want like a good outcome for everybody or what else, are cowed. We are caught up in this situation of being inherently, hypocritical, morally compromised.
Yeah.
You know? And like, Yeah.
On that note, should we get into our wildflower?
Yeah. And this is akin to the work that you were doing this morning.
Yeah.
I think that this is a short little article. So maybe we just do it as like a reading series.
Sure, let's do it.
I think it's like 600 words or something less. All right. So this comes to us courtesy of the BaltimoreBanner.com, which I guess is like a local press outlet in Baltimore. And the title of this article is, "Here's what Mr. Trash Wheel has accomplished in 10 years.
And he's so cute.
Yeah. This will be the episode art probably. Better than a self-immolation.
Yes, much better.
All right. Says, it's got this adorable looking contraption at a dock with big, I don't think the eyes like literally like rotate like googly eyes.
But they do look like googly eyes. Yeah, it's like very cute. Eyes.
It says, "The Trash Wheel family has collected more than 5 million pounds of trash and debris since the first one, Mr. Trash Wheel, was installed 10 years ago." The article begins. "One of Baltimore's most famous residents is celebrating his 10th birthday this weekend. Mr. Trash Wheel, the googly-eyed, solar-powered trash interceptor who sits where the Jones Fall meets the Inner Harbor, has been gobbling garbage for 10 years. The Healthy Harbor Initiative and the Waterfront Partnership are celebrating its 10th anniversary with a sold-out party Saturday night." There's a link to the sold-out party information if anybody's interested. Then Mr. Trash Wheel and his compatriots, Professor Trash Wheel, Captain Trash Wheel, and Gwinda the Good Wheel of the West, are fixtures in Charm City. It can be easy to let them blend into the fabric of daily life in Baltimore without really thinking about their impact. To honor Mr. Trash Wheel's birthday, the Banner took a look at what the Trash Wheel family has accomplished by the numbers."
All right. 5.2 million, the number of pounds of trash and debris the Trash Wheel family has removed from the water, according to the Waterfront Partnership. Anyone is able to view the data collected about how much and what kind of trash the wheels collect. 45,000 plus, the estimated number of homes that the Trash Wheel family has powered since the wheels have been installed. Waste collected from the trash wheels is taken to the incinerator in Baltimore, which burns it to generate electricity. That's pretty neat.
Interesting.
3,000, the approximate number of members in the Order of the Wheel, a not-so-secret society of Trash Wheel mega fans who commit to reducing their use of single-use plastics and cleaning up trash in their communities. Members get a special pin and learn a secret handshake.
That is a cool organizing tactic.
That rules.
Secret handshake. Fuck yeah.
123, the number of square miles of watershed that the Trash Wheel family collects debris from. Mr. Trash Wheel and Gwinda are both responsible for 60 square miles each. Professor Trash Wheel covers 2 square miles, and Captain Trash Wheel has 1 square mile. 4. The number of boozy beverages that have been created and named in the Trash Wheel's honor. I love it. There have been 3 beers: Mr. Trash Wheel's Lost Python Ale, a personal favorite of this author, Professor Trash Wheel's Blinded Me Wit Science, and Mr. Trash Wheel's Solar Power Sour. Oh, I like that one. There has also been Mr. Trash Wheel Strawberry Mint Hard Seltzer. Ooh, that sounds delicious. All the specialty brews have come from Peabody Heights Brewery. 2, the number of Balenciaga running shoes that have been collected by Mr. Trash Wheel. They came down the Jones Falls together and ended up in Mr. Trash Wheel's belly, said Adam Lindquist of the Waterfront Partnership. Lindquist said the shoes, which will be on display at the Trashzeum, created for Mr. Trash Wheel's birthday, retail for more than $1,000. And one, the number of live snakes that have been caught by Mr. Trash Wheel. Lindquist said 10 years ago, just 2 weeks after installing the not-yet-named trash interceptor, there was a heavy rain that allowed the wheel to thrive. More rain means more trash flowing down waterways. He shot a short video, which went viral, and the star known as Mr. Trash Wheel was born. And now, 10 years later, because of record-keeping and data collection, quote, scientists and policymakers from around the world have used our data to better understand the impacts of plastic on our oceans. We have helped make Maryland the first state to ban foam takeout containers and helped Baltimore City and County ban plastic bags, Lindquist said.
Fuck yeah.
Hell yeah, Mr. Trash Wheel, Captain Trash Wheel, Professor Trash Wheel, and Gwyn the Good Wheel. We love you. You're adorable.
Yes. And thank you for everybody involved in this effort. It's very cool.
It is. It,
yeah. This is, you know, like a really exemplary wildflower. You know, it's people doing something about a problem that they see.
Yeah.
And also doing it in a way that's like really good propaganda.
And very fun and quirky. Yeah.
It's both effective and just like, it's honestly really inspiring. I wonder like what it would take to make a trash wheel for like between Albany and Troy where there aren't any locks.
Yeah.
Like
that would be pretty cool.
That'd be something. That'd be a lot better than lighting myself on fire.
Yeah. So, yeah. So make a trash wheel.
Yeah. Maybe after the album's done.
But I have to say, if you want to feel good about something, go out and pick up trash. It is shocking how much plastic there is just embedded in our planet. And like, go out there and it really does. It's one of those few like concrete things that you can do to just feel a little bit better about your day. Actually get something done, material, physical, that like we have just so little of that. Even in hardcore organizing, it can be really hard to feel like you made a gain. So go on the next nice day. Don't do it today because it fucking sucks outside today. But on the next nice 60 degree and sunny day, I highly recommend getting your little clamps and a trash bag and go around and pick up some plastic.
Fuck yeah. Be the trash wheel you want to see in the world.
And I think that'll do it for this episode of Iron Weeds. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back with David next week. Thank God. but in the meantime, you can find us on Twitter,
Ironweeds Pod,
and on Instagram,
Ironweeds Pod,
and you can send us an email if you'd like to at ironweedspod@gmail.com. Oh, thank you so much. We love you. Bye bye.
Peace.